Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, as always. On this week's programme, the future of policing. Is it Minority Report, Robocop, or something else completely? Stay with us to find out. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Joining us on the programme to look back at the week's science news are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from Research Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. Our first story, Shane, has to do with space diplomacy.
Yes, this is a first for me on this show, talking about legal matters. So in 2022, the US sent the first moon-based mission in over 50 years. The last time that a person stepped on the moon was 1972, which is incredible, 52 years ago. A different world. It's like you weren't even born then, Jonathan, I think.
How?
So as well as there being a rocket-style mission, there is also a diplomatic mission. So the US said, we go together. This was their catch cry in 2022. They didn't want it to be kind of Cold War 2.0. They wanted to bring humanity to the moon. They wanted to have the first woman on the moon and the first person of color. And to do that or support it, they have something called the Artemis Accords. So the mission is called Artemis, and these are sort of diplomatic accords that are going alongside it. Artemis, of course, being the goddess of the wilderness, also the hunt, nature, and childbirth. So if you ever speak to anyone from NASA, you might ask them why they chose Artemis. I'd love to know which of those. I assume it's the wilderness. So they're saying the big news here is that they have 45 countries signed up to the Artemis Accord, and 12 countries alone have signed since January. I looked at the list of countries, and surprise, surprise, Ireland is not one of the signatories, which is disappointing. I think we would consider ourselves a kind of a nation now that has our eyes on outer space. We sent our first satellite into space last year.
But come on, we're very I'm not sure we're one of the top 45 spacefaring nations. And also, isn't it possible we just missed the email?
Well, that possibly is the answer. But some of the signatories are other small European countries. So I do think if anyone's listening, they should put their diplomatic hats on, and maybe we need an ambassador for the moon. There's logic to this as well. As well as us kind of talking about peaceful accords for outer space, there is also the issue of near-Earth objects. So the policing and monitoring of things like satellites that control so many aspects of our digital lives nowadays, from GPS down through internet, etc. It would be important for a nation like Ireland that considers itself a leader in innovation to be part of something like this, I think.
What exactly are the accords? Is it like just an agreement not to pollute the moon, or not to use it as a military space base to fire lasers at the United States of America?
Yes, exactly. And it is led by the US. It's a global alliance for peaceful space exploration. And its counterpart is one that's led by China and Russia, who are always the villains in the story nowadays when it comes to these sorts of things. They have plans.
Have they signed the accord?
No, they haven't. They have their own thing. They have plans to put a...
They have a different accord? I mean, that sounds like a discord.
Yeah, it's a discord. They have a plan to put an international lunar research station on the south pole of the moon by 2035. And critics are saying this is just masking military sort of reasons for the Chinese doing this. Let's see what happens, Jonathan.
Okay, interesting. So lots of people have sort of joined, but is it actually having any effect other than, you know, a bit of PR? Is joining this accord doing anything for space research or any congruence in terms of policy or development?
It has the potential for that. So there is a lot of interest in exploiting things in space. We've heard stories on this show about mining on the moon, etc.
Yeah.
It's really important that we have basic principles that we agree on, that things like research funding can be built upon, so people know kind of the parameters in which we're all meant to behave.
Okay. Ruth, our second story, I would say, is probably the most interesting one of ours, and that is to do with the Paris catacombs. What are the Paris catacombs, and what have we found out about them?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a research story, but it's research that's only just beginning. Often we're talking about research when we've got to the end. But the Paris catacombs are essentially a vast network of tunnels and quarries that exist under Paris. They used to be limestone quarries, but in the late 18th century, there was basically far too many dead people in Paris and the cemeteries were overflowing and it was getting very unsanitary. So a lot of the bones of people were moved into these tunnels that had originally been quarries, presumably where they took stone to build the city. And bodies were just sort of dropped into these open spaces. And it was over 200 miles of tunnels.
What?
200 miles of tunnels. And there's a little bit that, I mean, you can go and visit the catacombs. If you go to Paris, you can go and see them. And over time, some of the bones, rather than just being dropped in there, it was felt they needed a bit more respect and they were kind of neatly arranged. So people may have either visited or seen pictures that they sort of decorated the walls with the bones. So you can see walls of skulls and walls of different kinds of bones in there. But there's possibly, you know, there's 6 million people are now under the streets of Paris. Their bones are in these catacombs.
Oh my God, I didn't realize it was that many. Creepy AF.
It's enormous. And it's huge and only parts of it have been open to the public. But now it is becoming a research programme. So researchers from the University of Versailles and the research of Saint-Quentin-en-Yvelines have launched the first ever study of these catacombs. And it's interesting. It kind of reminds me a little bit of sort of building massive cathedrals in the past, like Notre Dame. These researchers are saying this will be many lifetimes work to go through all this because we will learn new things all the time. They do have some preliminary findings. So as they look at the bones, they're finding things, as you might expect, rickets, a bone disease caused by vitamin D deficiency. So it's indicating that many people in Paris back in the Middle Ages lived in very poor conditions with poor nutrition. As you might again imagine, they're finding evidence of different kinds of diseases like syphilis and leprosy. You know, these were prevalent at the time. So this is confirming what we knew. But over time, as we get better and better technology, we're going to be able to extract DNA from these bones and we're going to learn about the evolution of these diseases since then. And we're also, they're picking up things like people in Paris suffered from lead poisoning. So obviously pipes at the time and cooking utensils, they may have put lead on them in cosmetics. So these are just all the very early findings that are happening now. We can see that people had amputations, people had trepanations done. So early surgeries where they would have drilled into the skull.
The stories of these bodies, like I'd say, each one is fascinating. Yeah. Can I ask, has there been a lot of research done on these? You sort of hinted that they haven't. I mean, surely this would have been a treasure trove for researchers.
Well, I think very little has been done now. And that's why there's such excitement about this, that there's now a formal structure in place. And exactly, actually interesting, a bit like the story of the moon. When it comes to big research things, often it does take time for someone to establish a framework when researchers can actually get in and look at these things, because there would be ethical considerations here. And obviously, you know, these all lie under one of the busiest cities in the world. So there's logistical challenges with getting in and getting permissions to do that. But as you said, I think there are going to be so many stories and this will be a really wonderful area for interdisciplinary research, which is very exciting because you can see, you know, the scientists and the archaeologists kind of coming together with their colleagues in the humanities and historians and putting the stories together for us.
Very cool. Looking forward to the output of that research over the next few years. Our third story has to do with big machines. We love big machines on this program. Shane, what is this one?
This is a giant whopping magnet, Jonathan. Magnetism, you say electricity is your sort of Achilles heel. I think magnetism was always mine as a student. It was always the area in physics. I was like, what is this? It just sounds like magic. So magnetism is caused by the movement of electric charge. So electrons. Every atom has electrons around them and they have a property called spin. And that spin causes the individual electron to act as a tiny magnet. Now, in most atoms, the spins going one way are cancelled by the spin going the other way. So you get zero net magnetic field. In some elements like iron or cobalt or nickel, the spins tend to go in more one direction than the other. So their magnetic properties are evident. They generate what's called a magnetic field, which is that they can attract or repel things. So it's like an electric field. It's a force. It's one of the four fundamental forces. And we measure the strength of magnetism in the magnetic field in a unit called Tesla, named, of course, for the car. No, it's named.
I got it, Shane. I got your physics joke. You'll be delighted.
Thank you.
One person got it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. So the Tesla, of course, named for Nikola Tesla. And so the strength of magnets is measured in Tesla. And typically magnets that we'd be familiar with, say like a strong one, like an MRI machine, would be 1 to 3 Tesla. Or if in a university, you might use an NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance machine. And that it could be up to 7 Tesla or so. This one is 42 Tesla, right? It is incredible. This is a big whopping magnet. And it seems, I read about it in Nature, the journal, that they're doing it just because they can. They're doing it because they're hoping, as we always do, to look for new physics. It would be an amazing research tool to be able to do experiments, and it would be much more sensitive than any magnetic tool we have at the moment. But there is a cost to having this great big magnet. It needs 32.3 megawatts of energy, and for equivalent here, that's half of 1% of peak power demand in Ireland on a day like today.
Okay, that's a lot of power.
And I reckon, this is my back of an envelope, I reckon that it would cost 12,000 euros per hour to run it. So I can only imagine the poor PhD student that's told to go down and run the sample, and then they realize halfway through they've made a mistake, and they have to go back to their supervisor and say, made a mistake.
They've left the machine on.
Yeah.
Like, left the immersion on.
Exactly.
The physics extreme version.
12 grand an hour.
Do they have any idea? I mean, is it really that basic that they don't know what they're going to get out of it, and they're just going to turn it on and see what happens?
I know. I'm being facetious. They do have great plans. So with stronger magnetic fields, you can look with far more accuracy at the chemical makeup of things. You can do experiments you wouldn't be able to otherwise do. It's a brand new research tool that it's leading to a whole new area, but costs a fortune.
Ruth, our final story is one of those ones where you kind of go, oh, it's a story of a company that was found to be screening embryos for IQ for cash, which of course is not possible.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is it's an expose, really. It was published in The Guardian, but it was kind of a bit of a sting operation that was done by this campaign group called Hope Not Hate, where they pretended to be someone who was interested in availing of this technology, and had a number of meetings with this US startup company called Heliospect. And as you say, Heliospect are promising couples that they can screen embryos for a whole range of different traits. So intelligence kind of was the headline one, but also things like height, risk of obesity, risk of other diseases. And of course, this is of concern. I mean, there's loads of layers to this story. I mean, one thing is the cost of the services. So they're marketing this service for about $50,000 to screen 100 embryos. And they're claiming that if you could obtain an IQ increase of more than 6 points if you took the best, in inverted commas, embryo. And of course, as we know, intelligence is not a simple genetic trait. It is a trait that is influenced by many, many genes, and each one of those genes has a small impact. But of course, this is because it's complex, you could have a scenario where a pattern that is associated with high intelligence with a particular environmental surrounding, so this whole nature and nurture thing, you could find out that that individual ends up with a fairly average IQ, even though they may have the genetic signature that could be associated with high IQ. So there's the issue about the pricing, there's the issue about whether this can even be done at all, and I think that is hugely contentious. And then there's also the issue that they're only able to do this because they are taking data from a UK biobank, a public biobank that has been set up to do research in the public good. And 500,000 people have donated their genetic information to that database for life so that it can be used for kind of public good projects. Now, what people are saying is that this company hasn't technically broken the access rules for that database, but it's obviously going to give people cause for concern if this is the way that data is being used.
For sure. I mean, I guess if someone has donated their data and it says, look, it's open access and you can use it for whatever, this wasn't the case, and is rarely the case in my understanding of any data. But if that was the case, then you might say, look, it's open data and so on. But if people are giving, you know, very sensitive information for common good, and then someone's packaging up some of the insights from this data as a rip-off service, and that's my own opinion, to give people something that is very difficult to quantify whether or not they get in the end. That's kind of really tricky. You said screening 100 embryos. Does that mean, how would they get 100 embryos?
I mean, you're right. Most people who are doing IVF won't have 100 embryos, but they are apparently, some of the people involved in this study have a track record of talking about things like creating artificial human eggs in the future. So, you know, there are sort of some, I think there's some sinister elements to this story. There are people who've been involved in things like trying to make a case for what they call liberal eugenics, and this idea that it is the right thing to do to give your child the best chance by giving them the best genetic package you can. But as we've said, the science doesn't really support that. And of course, as a society, that has not really been discussed, because we can't put our head in the sand and pretend that there will never be any possibility to do these kind of things technically. So I think that means we have to start having discussions about them, and to say this kind of screening is not legal here and it's not legal in the UK, but it is legal in the US at the moment where this company is incorporated.
Yeah, this idea of designer babies has been around for a long, long time. Mm. Now it's being marketed as a real thing. So all that discussion needs to, solidify into some sort of policy or legal framework, because I think it's kind of crazy to be selling these as services that really are not really defined by science yet. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, thanks so much. Now, from RoboCop to Demolition Man to Minority Report, the future of policing has been a constant staple of science fiction. Obviously, most of what we see on screen is plain ridiculous. But at the same point, law enforcement can't exactly stand still when it comes to technology, as everything around us becomes infected with it. So what is coming down the line in the real world? Well, Martin Mullins is director of Transgero and professor of risk management at the University of Limerick. He joins me now. Where are we when it comes to technology and policing, Martin? Because predictive policing and being able to spot criminals through disguises and all of these ideas have been out there for some time. Mm. What can we actually do using technology to help keep us safe?
Okay, so thanks for having me on, Jonathan. So I think I could start with a brief anecdote, if I may. So last year I went fishing with a group of guards, and we drove back up through Cork, through Limerick. And what I was impressed by was just their knowledge of locality, where crimes are being committed, where crime hotspots exist. So guards, especially in Ireland, have a very acute psychogeography of crime. But things are changing.
Psychogeography of crime?
Yeah.
It's the first time I've heard that phrase.
Yeah. Though, if you walk around a city with a guard, you'll pick up pretty quickly that they understand, they recognize faces, they know buildings, they know the history of a particular area in terms of crime. Right. But crime is changing, of course. It's going online. You might know that, say, burglary rates in the UK are collapsing because criminals don't really want to put their face on the line when there's easier options, more digital options available for the criminal fraternity. So criminality is moving online, and that's a different type of challenge for a guard, because that psychogeography ceases to be useful. And so how do you police the digital domain? So we've seen over the last few days alerts in terms of cybercrime. We've heard that it's cost in the region of 200 or 300 million in terms of victims in Ireland. So how do the police interdict? How do they supervise? How do they survey this space? And our project and another project that I've been working on called Anti-Finter, so both Empower and Anti-Finter, allow police the tools in order to work in this domain. So one challenge, for example, is the dark web. It's huge domain.
Dark web is just a sort of an alternative internet in where there's no laws.
Where there's not much in the way of laws, where you don't Google, but where shop fronts open and close down all the time. So I was in The Hague recently at a security conference, and we had a live demonstration of what the dark web looks like in terms of criminality. And they showed us a number of working drug sites, drug dealer sites that actually work. So these are out there. They open.
So basically you can order drugs, presumably child pornography, all sorts of illegal contraband and so on, arms, hacking programs, all these things are available on the dark web.
So if you, so that's the challenge for police. So you can imagine we have this vast domain. We have limited resources in terms of policing. So what's the solution? So we need AI in order to help the police, if you like, survey this domain and find high risk shop fronts on the dark web. And so what they use is image recognition software in terms of AI. They use text recognition software in terms of AI. And then they zoom in on a site that might be selling guns. Then they look for the cryptocurrency wallet. Then they follow the money. And that's how that kind of triangulation is how guards operate in this domain. Without the AI.
I thought the crypto stuff was completely and utterly anonymous. I thought you couldn't trace crypto.
You can trace it from wallet to wallet. So it's not as effective a tool for crime unless you have a pretty sophisticated IT backup as a criminal.
Right.
So you need to be able, you know, if you're using conventional bitcoins through conventional exchanges, that doesn't work. Like the police are onto that. You may as well use an IBAN number now.
Really? Wow. Okay.
So they have methods. They use mixers. They, if you think of it like a submarine, they actually cash out in domains where European law enforcement isn't able to see what they're doing. So the Anti-Fintech project, which I was in, wearing my UL hat, that was essentially designed to interdict terrorist groups raising money on the dark web and selling guns and buying guns. So that was what that was.
How do you design an AI program to infiltrate an online arms group selling stuff on the dark web?
So I suppose the first step in this procedure is you need some piece of AI that can identify images that are used by terrorist groups so you can trawl quickly through the dark web.
Right.
So typically how they raise money is they show an image of an attack, be it in Iraq or in occupied in Gaza, or it could be the Palestinian territories. So they use an attack and they raise money on the back of that attack. So if you have a piece of AI software that picks out guns, explosives, that type of imagery, you can start to narrow down the search quite quickly.
So just walk me through that for a second, if you don't mind. Yeah. They post an image or a video of an attack, and then almost like a GoFundMe page for terrorism, they then look for cash to then spend money on arms. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So they use a crypto address, and then they encourage people to send money through cryptocurrency. At their side, they're not very vulnerable because they're sufficiently sophisticated to mask their identity. The people who are vulnerable are the people sending the money.
Yeah.
Because the police can track transactions, again, using AI from wallet to wallet.
Right. And so it was that just used for terrorism and arms dealing, or was that program also for drugs or other things?
Yeah, so I'm talking about two projects here today. So one of them is Anti-Fintech, which was largely looking at high-level organized crime and terrorism.
Okay.
And the second project that, as Trangiro, we've been working on is called Empower. And what Empower seeks to do is introduce AI-based tools into the police force, so in three domains. So one of them is audio. So, Jonathan, I don't know if you've seen the film The Conversation, but I highly recommend it. Gene Hackman, it goes way back. But one of the issues that the police run into is when criminals think they're under surveillance, they use certain strategies to avoid being heard properly. So you can imagine what they're, you know, it's hard. It's easy to filter some noises. I'm not going to go into the details because it's kind of sensitive, but some noises are easy to filter out and other noises are not easy to filter out. And so criminals go into spaces where it's not easy to filter out their noise and they talk quietly. And so we've got a piece of AI under development that can overcome that issue.
Wow.
A second piece of equipment that we have, this is a more sensitive area. In the police force, they refer to it as CSE, so child sexual exploitation. So a lot of what we do in Empower is designed to interdict this type of crime. So in this world, there are children rooms where they give evidence. So we also have AI that facilitates that, makes it more efficient, it means less exposure for police officers as well. the AI can pick out children's voices. It has a lexicon of the types of word that children use in this domain. And it can forward this on to judicial authorities in order to get a very quick decision in terms of warrants and child protection and so forth. So that would be that. We also have video AI. One of the more interesting ones is on guns. So a piece of AI that takes a lot of video feed and essentially looks for guns on the street.
Right. So
it's easy to find guns using AI on the web because you have a picture of a gun and you can find it. But what's much more challenging in this project is looking for guns that have been held by people.
Right.
Because you can imagine they hold them across their bodies, they hold them down, you can only see the barrel. Not only guns, but also different types of weapons. It could be machetes. So essentially this piece of AI, if someone attacks someone on the street, the AI will take video feeds and try and identify an individual who's carrying a weapon.
Right. Yeah. I can see why that would be very useful. Yeah. And in terms of real time, is that possible to be able to look at real time CCTV footage across the city and identify if anyone on that camera, on any of those cameras, is holding a weapon? Because if you could do that in real time, that could be hugely helpful, right?
Yeah. So it is possible, technically possible. So this is a real time, if you like. So in the States more recently, they have real time crime centers. Essentially, these real time crime centers take feeds from police on the beat, from body cams, and the AI behind the body cam can give, through the real time crime centers, can give the police on the ground a readout of the psychological state of the potential perpetrator,
wow,
suspect. So,
oh my God,
we're moving quite fast.
CCTV footage could see if someone was staggering or if they were running. There's obviously patterns to shootings, for example, people run in certain ways. It can actually track body movement and say, look, it looks like something's going on here.
Yeah, it looks like. So it could be as simple as the AI looking, using the body cam of an officer and just coming back with a fairly, fairly basic readout of this suspect is agitated. So it could be red flag, orange flag, kind of that type of world. So
If it's on a body cam, why would that be useful? Surely the police officer could be able to figure that out themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. But what this does, it gives you another layer. It gives you another layer that potentially protects the suspect and potentially protects the police in terms of legals.
Let's talk about use of AI in the future. You know, if we can look at behavior of someone, for example, looking at AI imagery of someone hanging around outside a building and that behavior sort of matches the sort of scoping out of something before someone commits a crime, is it likely that we might see people being arrested on suspicion of being about to cause a crime? Is that on anyone's radar just yet, or is that ethically just hugely problematic?
Well, it's problematic because no crime has been committed. So essentially what you're talking about there, Jonathan, is predictive policing.
Yeah.
So predictive policing has always been a thing. So when I was a kid, I used to go to football matches in London, and if Millwall were playing, there'd be a lot of police there. So that's predictive policing. So, but more sophisticated versions of predictive policing, I was talking with a colleague to give you an example. So it's looking at footfall from drones, say, and what they're trying to pick up is where in a particular housing project are drugs being sold. And essentially what they do is they look at footfall patterns. And if there's a strong footfall pattern into a particular house and it's not a shop, there's your dealer.
Right. So,
That kind of AI technology allows, that's not even predictive policing, that's more real-time policing.
Mm.
Predictive policing, most current example I have is a system called Heat in Chicago, but that is predictive policing. So they use a mixture of social media tracking. So they have a list of about 1,000 suspects. And in order to cut down on gun crime between gangs in Chicago, the software tries to predict where the next hit is going to be.
Oh,
and they assign police to those areas, swamp the areas in order to deter criminal activities. So that's the kind of, they're the types of approaches. All of these, if you, as you I think I can gather through your tone, they all kind of carry kind of ethical dilemmas with them.
Yeah, I was going to ask, that's my last question. I mean, where do we go with the ethics of predicting someone creating a crime or causing a crime?
Yeah, so one of the strong USPs of the Empower Project is that we have ethicists and lawyers in at the ground floor working with engineers. So we have a kind of ethics or good governance by design built into the project. We also talk to investigators as to what they actually want, because there is a sense of technological determinism here. In terms of the ethics of all of this, like, it's pretty binary. So you can imagine a situation where you had drones flying over the north side of Dublin or Dublin city centre. They wouldn't be much street crime after a period, because they'd pick it up quite quickly in terms of the patterns of behaviour, in terms of the usual suspects. Mm. But the price that we'd pay is that we're under surveillance. So it's either we move towards this either utopian or dystopian, depending on your point of view. So
yeah, ask those who live in Singapore, I guess. Yeah, just finally, obviously, the huge challenge here is to ensure that it's equitable and safe. AI, we know a lot of bias is baked in. How do we make sure that these predictive policing policies don't affect certain minority groups disproportionately?
I've been working on how insurance companies use big data for a long time, and inevitably what comes up on the list is, in terms of crime and in terms of certain types of antisocial behavior, the hotspots tend to be in lower socioeconomic areas. They tend to correlate with certain types of nationalities and different types of ethnic groups and so forth. So to some extent, you know, if it's a numbers game and if we're looking for crime hotspots, it does tend to correlate to poor people. And so it's largely going to be poor people who are going to be under surveillance. There's no need to have too many drones flying over flying over the south side of Dublin or Killiney Hill, because you're not going to see too much down there. But where you will see the surveillance is in poorer areas, poorer neighborhoods. Mm. And that adds further stigma.
Yeah.
Adds further sense of kind of a lack of value, and introduces kind of political problems.
No, it's an ethical mess, to be honest. And yeah. It'll be interesting to see what comes out and how challenged some of these laws are. I imagine the European Union will be kind of careful about what path it treads over the next few years. It'll be interesting to see how legislation follows when it comes to the ability of AI to be involved in policing. I know the EU AI Act does touch on this sort of thing. Really interesting. Professor Martin Mullins from the University of Limerick and Transgero, thank you so much for joining us.
Jonathan, thank you.
It's crazy to think about all of the issues that spill out of constant AI supervision in the skies. Your thoughts on that, please. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. That's it for us on this episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.